Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Galway in Ireland, but it's the city and people of Cork that seem to have captured her heart. Her new novel is the third in her series, which explores the underside of the city and the lovable characters trying to find their way with the odds stacked against them. The following conversation was recorded at Hay Festival, Wales. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us. I'm so sorry that you can't be here in person. But as you did point out, that means that you didn't have to wear a mask and your lipstick still looks fabulous.
Well, thank you for letting me know. I'm looking at my webcam here and I'm going, yeah, I think it's OK. Yeah, this is the one advantage to patching in from home. I can still look relatively decent and normal. Thank you for having me.
I thought it might be useful to start by talking a little bit about your own life and your upbringing, so far as it informs this great series of novels.
Just to get that out of the way, so these books are very much working class books, and my background is very much a working class background. So, and it's funny because I'm often asked like things like, did you feel the need to represent these people, these forgotten voices of literature? And I'm like, no, not really. To the degree that these are the stories of people that I grew up with, or people that raised me, or people that I've come into contact with, and kind of naturally I'm drawn to them rather than really feeling the need to represent anything. But I'm not from Cork. All these books are set in Cork City, which is Ireland's second city. And like all second cities, it has a tremendous chip on its shoulder and it believes that it is the real capital. And I have to say I'm on board with this. I actually agree too, because I'm very much, I've drunk the Kool-Aid when it comes to Cork, absolutely. But I was brought up on the west coast of Ireland. I had a lot of time in Cork as a child growing up. I used to spend holidays there. I had cousins down there, went to university there, met the husband there, the whole lot. So for me, when I started writing these books, it's the Cork accent that the characters came out with.
And your writing, in fact, sprang from your blogging career. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, career is such a lovely word to use, Georgina. I don't know if I could use it myself, but basically. So back in the day, blogging was briefly quite fashionable in Ireland. And it was also around the time, I don't know if anybody else will remember this, but it was around 2007, I think. And the Sunday Times had published this article. What they'd done is they'd taken a submission for agents and editors based on the first 50 pages of In a Free State by V.S. Naipaul, and they had submitted this blindly, anonymously. And every single one of those agents and publishers, they all turned it down. In fact, barely any of them even responded or got back. And so certainly none of the people who had been contacted or even recognized this Nobel Prize winning piece of literature. So I remember thinking, like, this is me. I was a young mum at the time. I was like in my early 20s. I was living in a council estate in the west of Ireland. And I was like going, oh my God, there is no hope whatsoever for me as a writer. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And talent has nothing to do with it. And here we were living in a world where, you know, glamour models were on their seventh autobiography, but like, I can't get published with literary fiction. So I was panicking a bit. And blogging being this kind of what felt like a very democratic platform, it felt very accessible. All you needed was an internet connection. And it was for me the concept of, well, if I can go out there and build a readership and maybe gain some attention, at least then I have some body of work to show to an agent or publisher when the time comes. So it was a very deliberate way for me to, I suppose, get the foot in the door. And luckily it worked.
And what was the spark for the trilogy? I mean, did you always mean for it to be a trilogy, or was it just originally one book?
No, I think it was always going to be three books, I think. I knew that the characters, once they started coming to me, there was too much in it for one particular story. It would have been a really quite a hefty novel if I just tried to do one particular story. But the idea came to me around the time that I was blogging, and I'd written a short story that was published in the Faber anthology Town and Country, which was edited by Kevin Barry. And from that, I got my agent and he asked me, well, what would you like to do? I had the idea that you had to write a collection of short stories first before they would allow you to blossom into a novelist. I don't know where I got this. This is the Irish thing. This is because I'm from Ireland. I assume that's what you had to do. So I was originally kind of looking for ideas for short stories. and kind of ideas for characters that might become the protagonists of short stories. And one of these ideas that I had was of this lady of late middle years. And I think she, in my head, it was around the time where perhaps women start to become quite anonymous, or certainly people or society starts looking at women as though they're beyond great adventures or even misdeeds. So I had this idea of this woman of that age, and she was walking down Patrick Street, which is the main street in Cork City, and she was marvelling that all around her were people and none of them could guess that she'd just done something terrible. And I figured, oh my God, she's killed somebody. And she's wondering, will people work this out? Or she's amazed that people can't work this out. And the character of Maureen had existed in my head for a very, very long time, looking for one of these particular stories that I thought she'd fit into. It was just, oh my God, that's it. That's my instigating moment. That's what's going to set off this, what I still thought was a collection of stories that were going to be interwoven. So I spoke to my agent and he said, do you want to write short stories? Have you any? And I said, well, really what I want to do is I want to write a novel. He said, write a novel then. You know, where are you getting this idea about short? It's much easier to sell a novel. Yeah, so I did. So once I knew what that instigating moment was and I knew her as a character, and once you think you know the characters very well, they kind of tend to take over. And it came together, I think, very quickly, which I know sounds a bit mad. I'm talking about three books, but I think once I had that momentum, the rest of it started kind of falling into place very fast.
I mean, the Rules of Revelation, this book, can be read independently of the others. You don't need to read the other two to appreciate this book. But for background, I wondered if you could just give us a quick tour, if you like. Tell us a little bit about The Glorious Heresies and The Blood Miracles.
So I think the central character for all of these books, I think that the heart of them all is Ryan Cusack is his name. And in The Glorious Heresies, we first meet him when he's 15, and we meet him again in The Blood Miracles when he's 20, going on 21, and now we're here at 24. And basically, The Glorious Heresies is what happens in the lives of five people after this instigating moment I spoke of a while ago, after Maureen, one of them, kill somebody, how the lives of five people who are very much existing on the society, how they're all intertwined, how they're all affected by this one terrible deed that cannot be taken back. But Ryan very much took off, I think, for me as the heart of that thing, clearly because he was the youngest and he was the one, I think, most capable of putting things right for himself and most capable of, I think, maybe gaining sympathy or certainly the most innocent of them. And for The Blood Miracles, then I almost wanted to twist that a little bit. Like he's gotten to the stage at this point where he's 20, he's going on 21, where we can start forgiving, or we can easily forgive him for things. In both of those books, he's a drug dealer, a teenage drug dealer, then to a young adult drug dealer who's getting quite successful at it and in danger of losing his soul. And yeah, pretty much at the end of The Blood Miracles leaves him quite shaken. So we meet him again here in The Rules of Revelation. And the concept for this one was, well, if you have this young man who's done these terrible things, who's kind of been a blight on society, who's been a drug dealer, it's not a profession that's easily forgivable or understandable to the rest of us. If you have him, if you send him away into exile and he comes home and he goes, well, actually, now I want to be an artist. I'm going to be a musician. And that's what I'm going to do with my life. Can he be forgiven? Should he be lauded? Should he be destroyed? So from the point of view of four other characters, Maureen being one of them, that's our old accidental murderer. Mel, someone who grew up next door to Ryan, who has, you know, their own dark secret or family secret. We have Ryan's ex-girlfriend, Corinne, who's now the mother of his son. And we also have a character who appeared in The Glorious Heresies, Georgie, who is an ex-sex worker who has her own bone to pick with Ryan. So it's quite, I'm glad you said it can be read alone. I really did hope that. I think it's another kind of polyphonic, cacophonous novel. I think it's good fun.
And it absolutely captures those voices, the vernacular, the rhythm of Cork. I wonder, though, if you were writing, did you write through the three novels or did you write each and stop? And if so, because the first two were so phenomenally successful, was it pretty daunting starting on the third?
Oh, you know, it was. There was a bit of a gap between the second one and the third one. I had to kind of regroup. I knew pretty much where it was going to end, and I knew what I had to do essentially, or what each of the characters, I knew what their ending should be, but just how to get to it was the thing. So there was quite a period where I was just staring at a blank page and going, Oh my God. And then trying to do that, trying to maintain that same energy from the first two, whilst knowing that people had read them and that they existed as products in the real world, and that people had expectations and people had likes and dislikes in terms of the characters. And it was very hard in that sense to write it without kind of letting the outside world in. So I think that's why it took me so long. Like I stared at this blank page for ages. And then, of course, I wrote about 20,000 words and then rewrote them. And then I wrote 40,000 words and rewrote that. So it was a bit more of a kind of a stop start, and one where I was doubting myself more. But once I can think I took off with it, it really did rattle on very happily for me.
As you say, there are four different characters, and then there's Ryan. As you write, of course, he's working class, but he plays the piano. He's also fluent in Italian. This book unravels so much about class, and it's something you go into very deeply in the book. But I wonder where those three separate things leave Ryan. He doesn't know. Do you? He's working class, but he has these other talents that wouldn't normally be found in a boy that lives where he comes from.
I think that's the interesting kind of thing. There's so much of that external, I suppose, parameters and judgments that he's working through in his own head. It's almost like he's expecting there to be problems with his being fluent in Italian, which is because his mother is Italian. It's not because, he went off and diligently learned it one day, and because he can play piano. It's almost like they like. In this situation, in this world, in this society, that will kind of say, well, these are incongruous. And he has to kind of think about that and go, well, actually, no, they're not. There's the, why would they be? And the interesting thing as well, for me, when I was writing it, there was a lot of talk about, well, how Ryan is essentially, he's quite extraordinary because of the fact that he can do this and he can do this. He has this talent. He has this. He's not really that extraordinary for the work that he was doing. As in for his wonderful career in the black market, for this kind of stuff. Not to be dobbing myself in, but I've known a few of these young fellas, and they do tend to be quite extraordinary in their own way, because it takes a lot of brains and balls and kind of like a very interesting way of looking at the world to be able to kind of take on this, I suppose, this deprivation and go, well, I'm not taking this, and to be able to, I suppose, shrug off morals. It's I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying in being extraordinary, I mean in a wholly benevolent way, I don't. But certainly it's almost taken for granted that working class guys don't have these kind of extra, I suppose, that these facets to their character, and they do, whether or not they're involved in the black market, they absolutely do. I mean, everybody has something. The world is full of people who will surprise you. So I think Ryan essentially is battling those prejudices that he's kind of almost accepted from just existing in Cork City in the time that he does.
I mean, Georgie has a wonderful line. She reflects, she says, no one gave a shit about the sin if the sinner was interesting enough. And I wonder how your readers react to Ryan.
I love this question because there's very much two camps with this. So I have some readers that think Ryan is wonderful in the sense that I guess they were there with him from the age of 15, and they do forgive him things, and they want him to be okay, and they feel quite strongly about this, and whatever I am perceived to have put him through, I get sometimes a bit of flack from people for it. But then you have this other camp that are equally valid and definitely there, who think he's just atrocious. He's a terrible person. He shouldn't be forgiven for any of the stuff he does, like the stuff that he pulls in towards the end of the Glorious Heresies in Blood Miracles. These are not necessarily things that are, just youthful japes. I mean, here's somebody who's making money out of drug dealing, and he was very, very good at it. This is not a good thing. One of my favorite reactions to Ryan actually came from someone's reaction to Corinne has been with him on and off since he was 15. They've grown up together. And one reader was telling me how much they liked Corinne and said, well, I'll tell you one thing. She's too good for that pup that she's with, which I was like, oh, yeah, that's perfect. And I think it's kind of funny, too, because I am sometimes accused of making Ryan too likable. And I'm like, well, I never said he had to be likable. There's a lot of people within the book, and there's a lot of people outside the book that don't like him at all. Real people and people within the world that he's living in. It's quite interesting that yeah, people's reactions to him, like never, I love them. Never seem to amaze me.
Then we come to the sort of intersection between class and gender. Mel wonders if Irishmen of a certain age had simply not been expected to love their children or their grandchildren. Is that a class issue?
Again, I feel very much that this is almost prejudices that are internalised by the characters and kind of wondering about. Mel says this in particular about their grandfather, who is quite an unpleasant person. And I think that I'm using they for Mel because Mel was assigned female at birth, but isn't necessarily too comfortable with it. I'm doing it there now. They're kind of non-binary, or they're trying to figure out what they are and who they are. So they're having a lot of thoughts about gender and a lot of thoughts about masculinity versus femininity and whether it's a spectrum and where or not they come from. So I think there is possibly a bit of kind of unfairness based on the fact that they don't like their grandfather. There's a bit of that too. But yeah, I mean, gender and class, this is something that fascinates me, because obviously we're having very interesting conversations about gender now, whether it's through the lens of traditional feminism or whether it's through the lens of kind of being critical of even the binary in the first place, whether that is. And often the accepted knowledge often or the kind of where people are coming from is very much through a middle class lens, very much through maybe a university educated, maybe quite academic kind of lens. And it does tend to, in a way, shut out from the conversation a lot of people who aren't necessarily from a background that's quite privileged. I don't mean like intentionally shut it out. I just feel that often somebody from a working class background, like my background, wouldn't necessarily feel too comfortable in that space, would perhaps feel that they were at a disadvantage in not knowing the academic terms and not knowing the history and not kind of having been through university activism or something like that. So I guess these things were in my head very much when I was writing The Rules of Revelation, and Mel was a great character to explore them through.
She really is. And I mean, Izzy has a sore jaw, and Mel again has these wonderful lines. She says, Mel wasn't sure whether Izzy was being graceful in hiding her pain, which was gendered behaviour and socially enforced, therefore Izzy should not be judged for it, or whether Izzy was at ease but looking for attention, equally irritating, equally gendered. I wonder what feminism then means to your characters.
So the interesting thing is, so each of these four voices in The Rules of Revelation was born female. Like Mel is the only one questioning, the other three, Corinne, Georgie and Maureen, are very much consider themselves women, and their experiences are viewed through kind of being quite comfortable in their gender and comfortable with who they are. Feminism is an interesting thing. So you have the likes of Maureen, who grew up during kind of like obviously the 20th century Ireland, which was very deeply Catholic and very deeply traditional, and women very much suffered under it, especially Maureen, who had a baby outside marriage and was pretty much exiled from her family because of it. So she has almost fallen between the gaps of this very, very traditional Ireland and this suddenly extremely changed Ireland, this Ireland that just in the last 10 years went from being kind of crawling out of the shadow of Catholicism, or like the kind of Catholicism that held such a grip on Ireland for so long, into this extremely secular and extremely accepting society, where we had two huge referendums in the space of 3 years. We had marriage equality and then we had the abortion referendum, both kind of won by a landslide and really upending everything we thought about traditional Ireland. And Maureen has battled kind of the first aspect of this. She's battled traditional Ireland, and then she's kind of come into this sphere where she's done nothing to kind of bring about this change. She's kind of feeling a little bit left out, almost like that this big dragon, this big Irish kind of frightening monster has been vanquished. And she's like, when did this happen and how did this happen and where does this leave me? So she's kind of fallen between the cracks, she thinks, almost. I think she says at one stage that she's kind of like, she's not revolutionary enough for the younger generation, you know, and she was never kind of traditional enough for the older. So she's had that. Then you have Georgie, who got into sex work in the Glorious Heresies, but not through any kind of informed choice and not through consent, really. Essentially, she got into it for financial reasons out of desperation and because a man pushed her into it. So for her, I would imagine feminism is probably something that she would almost kind of scoff at and sneer at and go, well, that wasn't much helpful. That didn't help me much now, did it? You know, that's kind of thing. Without kind of, I suppose, being able to or feeling like she's welcome in that space as well. And then for Corinne, she kind of very much comes from, I suppose, the kind of very supportive working class family, and to a degree has this kind of love for, this need for, this want to stay at home now with her son. And then she feels very kind of left out of these conversations too, because she's thinking, well, am I a bad feminist for wanting this? And her friends kind of tell her, look, you're just trotting around after a fella all day. And, you know, she thinks about Ryan all the time, and that's kind of pathetic. And so she feels kind of judged in this way too. So they're all kind of like, I think, very much people who are in their own heads, activists in their own heads, very involved in and very interested in these questions of gender and feminism and equality, but all just slightly off kilter and all just slightly feeling like they're getting it wrong. That was an interesting thing for me to explore, because I do think there is a sort of a gap when it comes to, I guess, this kind of almost commercialized sense of feminism and what we can do with it, and between women from certain socioeconomic backgrounds who just don't necessarily feel like they're part of that conversation.
But I mean, you also go into, and you give us some great examples of women being really supportive, women working in clumps, you call it, but also of women, I mean, again, Georgie talking about, she wonders if women aren't worse than men. So, I mean, I guess the question is, do you think that we, as women, are more supportive than destructive towards each other?
I do myself, but I can understand why a character like, and this is the interesting thing, because I do as myself, and this is my experience, to try and explore it from the point of view of a character who maybe doesn't feel the same way that I do, or has not had the same experiences that I do. Georgie would be very, I suppose, combative in general towards the world because of her experiences. The line you're referring to there, where she wonders if women aren't worse than men, is because she's having a hard time. I think it is. I can't remember my own work. I think it's because she's having a hard time with two horrible, horrible schoolgirls on a bus who are just being little wagons, you know? So, I mean, I think that in general, throughout the book, it's quite funny, because you can see various aspects of the kind of functioning legitimate society. In this case, we see women being supportive, being friendly, being each other's greatest champions. And then there's always like these characters, the likes of Georgie, who just doesn't seem to be accessing it, doesn't seem to be getting it, is just that little bit kind of on the outside still going, well, what am I doing wrong? You know, so, I mean, it's fun to explore it from that angle.
I mean, there are so many wonderful lines. I just found myself reading the book, just underlining stuff all the time that to do particularly with gender. You write, men are brave, women are brazen. And then that made me think about how that changes with age. So Maureen has the wonderful line, young women are to be conquered, old are to be feared, which I just thought was amazing and probably true.
I think so. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. As I get older, I intend to be very, you know, a person that is feared very easily. No, I mean, the brazen thing as well is the idea that any sort of defiance that a woman shows is kind of, it has to, like, in general, be against the status quo. So therefore, it's kind of seen as being something that's quite brazen, something that's quite challenging, you know, all of these things. And when you continue down in that route, I think you end up kind of feeling like Maureen. This is based on like older women I know, one of them being my grandmother, who is now in her 80s and really has long ago stopped caring what everybody else thinks. I mean, she has 80 years of knowledge and she is going to impart it, you know. So the fun there becomes writing characters who are coming from, I suppose, that level of experience or that kind of look at the world. It's fun, yeah.
Now, Maureen says that Cork, which is really a character in its own right in all three of the books, she says that Cork is a very male city. And she's on a quest, really, to find the female in the soul of the city. Tell us more about that.
This is quite funny, because Maureen has got it into her head that Cork is a very male place. This, for me, came from, there's a wonderful essay written by Kevin Barry for Granta called The Rain God's Green, Darkest Passion, in which he characterises Cork as a very male kind of city in that kind of energy, which I think he's correct. I think you'd have to be there to understand it. But Cork has that kind of little, like a kind of a squat little challenger kind of face to the whole thing. But Maureen, anyway, has this in her head that Cork is a very male place. And this is informed by her own experiences of it. I mean, like I said, she's the one that was battling Catholic Ireland. She's the one that kind of suffered for it. So naturally, of course, she's going to believe that Cork favours men over women. She's experienced this. She's felt it. It's very, very true. But what amuses me is that she has taken it as gospel that all of the famous children of the city are men. She hasn't really, just because she has no experience or no knowledge of the famous Daughters of Cork, she thinks nobody does. So she goes off on this kind of crusade, this very, very Maureen, very righteous crusade, and finds out that there actually is quite a few famous Daughters of Cork, just because she didn't know about them. And the kind of upsetting thing to her is that she realizes that one of them, a very famous, I suppose, the hero of the trade union movement in the United States, was Mother Jones, somebody that Maureen had completely discounted and hadn't heard about. So this forces her to reevaluate her entire philosophy about the city being a male place, and makes her think, well, maybe if the city isn't entirely male, then maybe it's my fault that I was never able to make them my mark on it. And then she has to reevaluate everything about herself as well. So it kind of puts her in a very, I guess, a very cranky position.
Lisa, thank you so much for being with us. And we'll have that virtual pub drink soon.
Oh, God, yes, please. Thank you.
The Rules of Revelation by Lisa McInerney is published by John Murray. It's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. This conversation was recorded at Hay Festival 2021, where 300 writers and thinkers gathered to reimagine the world. All of this year's events can be found on Hay Player now at hayfestival.org, along with the schedule of upcoming events. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.